This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm technical producer Eddie Garcia. Later this hour, we'll examine the headspace under Beethoven's wig, plunge into alligator wrestling-riddled prose, and top things off with a sneak peek at the debut album from Winston-Salem's Dark Prophet, Tongueless Monk. But first, Stuart McLamb and the Language of Love. Stuart McLamb is the creative force behind the North Carolina-based indie rock band, The Love Language. What started out in a Winston-Salem apartment as a lo-fi love letter developed into a panoramic indie pop pastiche. The band is known for its accessible wall-of-sound approach that harkens back to the days of Phil Spector and his recordings with the Crystals and the Ronettes. But beyond the strings, the horns, the glockenspiel, and the healthy dose of reverb, there's the songs. And singer, songwriter, guitarist Stuart McLamb has a knack for lyrics and melodies that burrow deep and stick around long after the concert stage goes dark. The most recent release by The Love Language is called Ruby Red. It's their third record and was released on Merge Records, the indie label that could, based out of Durham, North Carolina. You can see The Love Language live at Bailey Park in Winston-Salem for free on June 25th. It's part of the new Sunset Thursdays free concert series presented by Flo Honda and Wake Forest Innovation Quarter. The family-friendly event starts at 6:30, and if you're hungry, there will be food trucks on site. Before The Love Language takes the stage, you can see opening act Below the Line. Back in 2013, I talked with Stu via phone about Ruby Red, his days in Winston-Salem, and the evolution of the Love Language sound. New record, your third album, your second for Merge Records, Ruby Red is out. Congratulations on that.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, really, really enjoy the record. It's a little bit of a departure from some of your early stuff stylistically. I mean, but you know it's a Love Language song. You hear those, you know, reverb-drenched melodies. You know it's you.
Yeah.
But, you know,
Little reverb junkie
you are.
Yeah, working on it. I know it's an issue.
Has it always been that way? Like, have you always just had an affinity for it?
I don't know. The reverb thing started with that first record, first time I was recording stuff. So I guess it was more of a mask of like, okay, I don't know how to mic stuff. Put some reverb on it and you get that big sound. So it was definitely a part of this record, but we were using the real deal this time. So that was nice. Some plates and all that.
Okay. Where did you record the new record?
So we did it actually at Ruby Red, and it was mixed at Overdub Lane in Durham. Like, a good portion of it was mixed there. Actual recordings went down at Ruby Red, which is like a artistic sort of cooperative workshop in downtown Raleigh. A good buddy of mine, Tim Lemuel, rented the building. It was just like a sort of abandoned warehouse, you know, how that goes. And just kind of slowly started getting some artists, you know, visual artists and musicians and filmmakers, all kinds of artists in there, and slowly started turning into something really cool. Very similar, I guess, to like the warehouse, but I'd say we're a good 10 years behind with you guys there. So we just pretty much made like a makeshift studio to record in. You know, I was so happy with how it turned out. A big part of that was DJ Burton, who been my buddy for years, and he toured with the band for a while and record and engineered Libraries, our last record before this one as well.
So the atmosphere was a little different on Libraries too. You were in a studio where this was a new record. It's kind of like you made a studio happen in a really cool space you were working in. Mm-hmm. Now, on Libraries, did you, or maybe you and BJ, play most of the instruments on the record?
Yeah, like we had some people come in. Like my brother Jordan played drums on maybe a little less than half of the record on Libraries. It was mostly the two of us in there, but it wasn't like all the way like that.
You brought a lot more musicians into this record. And I'm thinking like a song from the new record, like High Life, has so many strings and maybe glockenspiel?
I don't know.
Yeah. And these horns. And I mean, how do all those arrangements get sorted out?
So that song in particular, when I remember I did the demo, that one was done in Black Mountain. I went out there for about 2 months in the summer of 2011 and sorted out a lot of the writing for the record. And we were like in this kind of, it was a cabin, but it wasn't like some remote cabin. It was like sort of in a residential area.
Did you grow a big beard while you were out there?
That demo, I think I just busted out like a standard like Casio that's got like the multi-tone banks, you know? Mm-hmm. Got like strings, horns, and everything. And I think I just kept layering with that until it had sort of a big sound just for the demo. I just kind of went back through and remembered what had worked. On this record are like really crazy for that. I mean, you know, when you bring in a string or horn player, they're classically trained and knowledgeable, so these are pretty easy to figure out. And then, you know, the strings are like one of my favorite parts of the whole record, and that was Rachel Rollins and Mark Paulson, really good friends of mine, live in Raleigh. It's sort of adorable. They're like a couple as well. Mm. They both play violin, but they added a lot to the arranging. They definitely helped me arrange certain parts.
I'm thinking about the song On Our Heels. Mm-hmm. Has that really simple but such a sweet, you know, little string line. Do they have something to do with that part too?
I think we did like kind of write that on the spot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely collaborative too. I think they helped me tweak like the end of the phrase or something.
Yeah, it really adds, you know, really a nice legs or something, especially with the song having like that kind of a laid back disco feel, like having those kind of strings.
Yeah,
kind of
that was
bop on top.
Like, one person kind of Cure kind of vibe or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, with this record, you're definitely trying out some different things.
You know, it's funny. I mean, there's parts of me that you listen to, like, the first record, and then you listen to this one, and it's, like, two different bands almost, you know. With Love Language never being, like, a constant live band, or I feel like it's a project that I'm going to kind of, like, as long as it feels sincere and it's with me, I'm going to try to take it along with me and my, like, you know, not trying to sound cheesy, like, my life journey or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, let that follow me to where I'm at as long as it feels like it's relevant, you know, tool for me to express myself. So that was one thing. I just felt like Love Language to start it out as like this sort of, you know, from this place of like lovelorn breakup songs, whatever you want to call it. That was something that would be really difficult to like perpetuate and like to identify myself with. So I just chose, like, I thought this record would be a good one to just totally break that mold and to open it up to some new themes and some new styles where like basically trying to like set the groundwork where I can kind of like take it wherever I would need to go. Like, you know, like I can try to do a 80s record or try to do something heavier or go back to doing like a lo-fi garage record next, like whatever. But just to like, for people to have no expectations about which direction you go, that frees me up to just, you know, not get stuck in a box.
It's kind of funny. I was like, well, the Love Language is not really a band in the traditional sense. You have a band,
yeah.
You are a band, but it's almost like the rapper for you. It's like your project. I mean,
yeah,
really, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, I've thought a lot about this and talked about it before. Like, you see this a lot more this day and age with bands, with members coming and going and switching, and people can afford to do like their own records by themselves at home and multi-track. And the band, and then in a lot of ways, all over is sort of, I don't know, it's not as tight as it used to be. I mean, there's still obviously bands, but I see that as like a lot of my friends' musical projects as people kind of come and go, and there's not even money in music anymore, you know. And so it's always usually these short-lived things, and this is something that I wanted to really push to kind of keep going. I mean, naturally, it is my thing, but I very much need people to, like, bounce ideas and feed off them and help bring things to light. But it just seems like, naturally, you know, it's sort of a revolving door. I think from the outside, people can look at it and be like, oh, Stu's like this tyrannical, I don't know, loving is like this crazy dictatorship, and he's firing people left and right because the lineup changed. But that's hardly the case. It's always been like more about like, well, that was a rad tour. I got a job offer. I'm going to do this. Or like, I'm really stoked on this project, or I'm moving to this town. I'm getting married. You know, that's been a lot of why people have come and gone, is just their lives have had things that come into their lives that were more important to them than this band, which I totally understand. It's like, I'm the broke dude in the band. Other people are doing cool stuff, you know. It's like people look at it the other way. It's like, why wouldn't they be in the band? It's like, because you make no money doing this.
Lyrically, this record, it's also stretching out a little bit. I know I talked a lot about the music and the sonics, but lyrically, it seems like there's more of hopeful, embracing, spirited feel. How did that all kind of come?
I mean, it took a long time to get this record out. I struggled a lot with writer's block, and I think that was me just trying to like sort of figure out how to get out of it, like the whole breakup theme or what I was supposed to write about. I don't know. I guess it was like kind of in a funky place, and then I started to write, but a lot of the lyrics actually came after Black Mountain. A lot of the music was done there, and some songs were completed lyrically then, but I came back to Raleigh, and I ultimately just decided it would be good to just explore like some more universal themes, you know. I realized that this was a good opportunity for the record to get outside of myself and my ego, would bring other people in, and not writing these songs with I and me all over the place. So I've always written from like sort of a cryptic kind of place. It's really hard for me to write a song about one particular thing, but I feel like it's always like a jumble. But one, like, it's vague, but the underlying theme of the record, I think, is just this feeling that this, like, new sort of era is approaching pretty swiftly, you know? I feel like everybody kind of feels it. It's hard to, like, put your finger on what it is, but technology is making these great leaps every day. We're, like, trying to catch up with that, and I feel like just the overall consciousness is, we're starting to, like, see through some of the old ways, and
things really seem like they've been in flux for a while, but now we're starting to get on the other side of it. Maybe I think people are finding new ways to do things, new ways to form
like,
their lives.
I mean, a really big change. I mean, I think yeah, exactly. It's like this weird moment where it's about to flip, kind of.
Yeah,
that was the theme. It's sort of like this like death and rebirth kind of thing going on in the record.
When you were kicking around town a couple of years back, why don't you tell everyone about your Winston-Salem connection?
Yeah, that started with the local superstars, Auto Passion. And we met them, my old band, The Capulets. We got up with them, and this was back in the MySpace days. And I remember a buddy of mine, William Cashin, who's in Future Island, actually, they were Art Lord and Self Portraits back then, but he mentioned, he's like, you should check out this band, Auto Passion. I think you guys would be a good fit. And we listened to it and just loved it. And we set up a show and went to Salem. They just, like, really simply became some of my best friends in the world and still are. Yeah, so then we just kept in touch and played some shows and met some girls in town. And I ended up getting in a pretty serious relationship with particular girl, and then I moved to Winston, and yeah, I stayed there for about 6 months, and yeah, it's funny, that's actually where a lot of those were the first Love Language songs were written, was living there, Gray Court Apartments. That's one of the songs on the first record, was Gray Court, because I was living out there. And that was pretty much it. I lived there for a while, and if you listen to the first record, you know that the it didn't all end in roses, but but it was, yeah, we're still good friends and everything, but it was 6 months of that I look back on very fondly, but it was a little rough in the middle of it.
So I just got to say, I'm very curious, what has the experience been like being on Merge Records?
When it happened, like when I got the news that we were getting signed, that was just something, you know, even though they're local, I just never imagined that would
like
be
a small label,
a reality for myself
in a lot of ways, too, you know, like label
and the right in my backyard. Happened, I remember I laid down on my bed. I just think I stared at my ceiling. I don't even know what was going through my head, but I swear I think it was for like 3 hours. I think I was just like sitting there, just like staring blankly at the ceiling. It was really like a dream come true. It's like, it's crazy to experience something like that, you know?
Yeah.
So it was for me. And, but I mean, as far as like them as a label, it couldn't be more laid back. It's just like, you know, they have such a far reach and they can do a lot for an artist. Obviously they've been doing it for a while and they've been in the business for a while.
And they've had some pretty major successes over the past, you know,
yeah,
5 to 10 years
too.
Yeah,
they know what they're doing. But at the same time, I feel so fortunate, you know, to not only just to be on that label, but for them to just be right in my backyard. It's a really great thing. It doesn't feel like they're like too big, you know what I mean, of an operation or something. It's still very personable.
They've retained their values.
Yeah, definitely. I think when they sign an artist, they really let them do their own thing. So it's funny, like sometimes
yeah,
I'm just like all freaking out, like, what do you think? And then they're just like, it's great, all right. You know? They're not like, they're definitely not one that's like, sit down, you have to pass the like Merge test. You know, they just let their artists express themselves and get behind it. I mean, if I like tried to rap on a song or something, we might have a conversation or something.
Maybe they make that a download only.
Yeah. And I got skills, you know.
I'm sure. All right, Stu. Well, it's been great talking to you.
Yeah, you too, Eddie. Pleasure.
Stuart McLamb. He's the musical brains behind The Love Language. You can see him and the band for free at Bailey Park on North Patterson Avenue in downtown Winston-Salem for free on June 25th. It's part of the new Sunset Thursdays free concert series presented by Flow Honda and Wake Forest Innovation Quarter. The family-friendly event starts at 6:30, and if you're hungry, there will be food trucks on site. Before The Love Language takes the stage, you can see opening act Below the Line. Stuart has another band called Soon, and we'll post a link to their decidedly heavier music and to The Love Language's lyrical pop at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. We have to take a short break, but when we return, it's violins and Beethoven with music director of the Greensboro Symphony Orchestra, Dmitry Sitkovetsky, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Our weekly arts plunge continues with an encore presentation of an interview between our own classy classical expert David Ford and violin master Dmitry Sitkovetsky. In April of 2002, a renowned Russian violinist was invited to perform Beethoven's Concerto for Violin with the Greensboro Symphony. That performance left a lasting impression. The chemistry between soloists and orchestra was just right, and the following year, the guest artist was appointed music director of the Greensboro Symphony Orchestra. Dmitry spoke with David Ford by phone from his studio in London, and he began by asking him about his musical use of time in his 2004 recording of the Beethoven Concerto with Sir Neville Mariner and the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields.
Beethoven composed this concerto while in his mid-30s. What sorts of things marked his compositional style at about this time in his life, Dmitri? How do they spill out into this work?
Well, I think Beethoven went through, of course, probably more than any other composers, through different stages of his life, depending on all the different struggles that he had. You know, of course, the continued struggle was with his hearing. And he was a titanic character, and so his crises were also titanic. But now and then, he would be in a much more peaceful frame of mind. They're very precious, those moments. And I think the violin concerto carries a lot of those. Maybe that's why today it took on a greater significance maybe than any of the piano concerto. And it sort of stands at the certainly at the summit of the violin repertoire, because there, in the violin part, altogether, there is hardly any conflict or Sturm und Drang, you know, any kind of stormy Beethoven that you think you know what music of Beethoven. One never really knows all of Beethoven because he was so many things. But when he had that peacefulness in him and he finally found his way to heaven or to the peace inside of himself, he was just absolutely divine. And I think this concerto, and especially, of course, the second movement, just represents something very precious, even out of everything that he wrote.
And unfortunately for poor Beethoven, it was a short-lived peace of mind. I've read a few juicy stories about the premiere of this concerto by Beethoven's good friend Franz Clement, beginning with Clement having to actually sight-read large sections in that performance. Is it, first off, is that true or false? And could you fill us in on how it fell upon folks like Joachim and later Mendelssohn to sort of rescue this work from oblivion?
I think that the history of the first performance was disastrous. And of course, not to a small measure was Beethoven's fault, because he was always so late in writing, you know, delivering the score. And so the performer, really, the violinist, had to literally just sight read, and then he felt he had to entertain the audience between the first and second movement. He played a piece of his own, holding violin upside down. And of course, today you cannot even think of a greater sacrilege than to do. But I guess in those days, rules were a lot more relaxed, and whichever worked for the public success was employed. So Beethoven was absolutely furious with the results, and he thought that he had given a stillbirth. In other words, he immediately, very soon after that, I think he made it for the piano. He made a version for the piano, wrote a cadenza with timpani in it, and that's it. And that was the last he heard of that concerto.
It's unbelievable. I could do a whole show on just the first and almost, you know, pieces that were just almost lost forever and disastrous beginnings.
I mean, surprisingly enough, another incredibly popular violin concerto suffered almost the same fate, and that's Tchaikovsky violin concerto. It was a disaster, the premiere, horrible review. Tchaikovsky never heard it again, even though it was played again, I think, in London, but he wouldn't even dare to go there. So that's it. And only after his death, Auer felt guilty that he'd rejected the concerto, and then he gave it to all of his great students, and they made it popular. They were all playing it, and it became also one of the most popular violin concerto, but not that Tchaikovsky ever knew of that. So Beethoven, actually, only posthumously, because of such an incredible figure as Joachim, and of course Mendelssohn, who was probably the greatest genius composer who promoted the music of the others as much as his own, maybe even more. So he brought back, of course, Bach had revival of. We probably would have never known Johann Sebastian Bach if it weren't for Mendelssohn. And so many other great pieces, like Schubert's Great Symphony was first performed by Mendelssohn, all posthumously. And so Beethoven Concerto was also one of the pieces he conducted. But of course, Joachim took it everywhere, and he played it, and he made it a popular, and then finally, you know, the audience realized that was an incredible piece of music. And it stood at the summit of violin repertoire ever since.
From your perspective as a performer, conductor, composer, arranger, why has this concerto become such a player's favorite?
You know, I would not say it's the player's favorite because it's incredibly difficult. He never really cared about, I think it belonged to him, the phrase. He said, who cares about the damn fiddle when the inspiration visits me? Something like that. He said that. And it's true. He really didn't care about the comfort. Brahms was a lot more conscious of that and consulted Joachim, of all people, very often to make it more violinistic. And, you know, Mendelssohn certainly wrote the most perfect violin concerto. Beethoven is not perfectly written for the violin because of a lot of it is pianistic writing, to tell you the truth. But it's such an incredible story. It's such an incredible piece of music. So compelling. The second movement is so divine. The first movement is epic, really. Just an incredible. It could have been a concerto in itself. But then the second movement just takes you completely to heaven. And then the last movement is so full of vigor and fun and humor and beauty. And it's just a sensational piece. I believe it's the best concerto Beethoven ever wrote for any instrument.
I find that when people say, some critics, they're out there, they say, oh, Beethoven couldn't write a melody. You just say, well, listen to the Larghetto from this concerto. I mean, it's some just beautiful
writing. Are you kidding? Well, my goodness. I mean, and it's, you know, my favorite cadenza to this concerto is by Fritz Kreisler. I mean, what he does, which is a stroke of genius, he combines two themes of the first movement into a double stop, double melody in the single, in the violin solo. It's quite extraordinary, and they fit so perfectly well. Probably one of the most melodic pieces Beethoven ever wrote. And as I said, in the violin part, all the more dramatic or more bigger gestures in the first movement, they all belong to the orchestra. Violin never really has all that Sturm und Drang in its part. It's very, very lyrical. It's very unlike your sort of archetype Beethoven kind of music.
I got a chance to see and hear your performance. This is on YouTube. Thank goodness for YouTube, of the famous third movement, Rondo Allegro with the NHK Orchestra. Was another Dmitri conducting, Dmitri Kitayenko.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
First off, I just love the tempo that you lock in on that. Not too fast, not too slow. How do you get that just right? I mean, how do you make those decisions, leading up to that performance in the moment?
Well, it's, you know, finding the right tempo, and in general in music, the question of rhythm and then the pulse and the tempo very often is more important than actually having an absolute pitch or perfect pitch, whatever they call it. And it is something that you have to have inside of you. And I think also for a conductor, the memory for tempi is one of the most important qualities to have. And being sort of a performer, conductor, for me, finding the right tempo and keeping it. You have to have a tremendous amount of homework done, but then when you come out, you have to feel the hall. You have to feel the audience, and sometimes you speed up certain things, and sometimes you slow down certain things, or you keep exactly the one that you brought out. It also depends on your pulse, you know, how excited, nervous, or whatever your state of mind. That all comes into consideration, and it affects one's performance.
I want to get off the stage for just a moment with you, Dmitri, and get into the recording studio, because 5 years later, you recorded this concerto with Sir Neville Mariner, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. Do you prepare differently for a recording session than for a live situation?
Yes and no. Yes, because, you know, in the recording situation, especially these days, you can't afford not to be perfect. While in a live performance, you can create an illusion of being perfect, but when you listen to the tape, it's actually not perfect. And if you, in a live concert, if you're trying to be perfect, you'll miss other important elements, spontaneity and risk-taking and all of that. But in the recording situation, where you have to have that lively feeling, like it is a live performance. I can't really listen to recordings that are so clearly just the recording.
How has your conception of the piece changed then over the, I mean, just the 34, 35-year history with this piece? Could you give us an example or two of how it's, you know, evolved over that time?
Well, I think one gets so much more familiar with the piece. It becomes your friend, your companion, or, you know, you're no longer just looking up so your neck hurts. You know, when you look up at the big mountain, your neck begins to hurt. You're always looking up. You know, so you sort of more on level terms, you feel more familiar. It's not so, you know, it seems like such an impossible task when you're just beginning to play. The first, I don't know, probably first 10 times at least, it's always daunting, you know, that concerto. But as you get closer to it and you feel familiar, it's sort of like a role that you've played. You know, if you've played Hamlet, I don't know, 100 times, you certainly found things there, and it's all in small. Devil is always in the detail, and genius is also in detail, in small things. It's not that I'm going to turn things upside down and, you know, and do it dramatically different. No, but it's the smaller things. And in my case, I think I'm interacting with every instrument, with every section, so much more now than I used to do it when I first started playing it. That I think that affects and enriches my playing, I think, a great deal, because I could react and respond to all the wonderful players there, and it gives me more impulses and ideas, and my responses are a lot more interesting over the years. So it very much depends on the company I keep.
The amount of rubato that you choose always seems so well thought out, and I'm just wondering if you could maybe describe, for non-musicians out there, describe rubato and how you make those decisions.
Yeah, well, if you think I take a lot of rubato on that recording, you ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, I take a lot more chances now and a lot more rubato, because I command the time a lot better now in my, you know, mature years. Because, you see, music does not consist of sound. Only. Music consists of sound and silence, air that's between those notes. And sometimes the pauses and breaks between those notes are actually more meaningful than the notes themselves. It's sort of like in life, you know, when you have an answer, so you have something concrete. But when you have a question, that propels one's development. You always should ask questions and question what you do and all that. So those, the air between the notes in a way that are like questions, that creates the atmosphere. And the true masters of the performance, of live performance, are the ones who are the masters of time. Because notes could be learned by a 12-year-old prodigy. He or she plays those notes perfectly. And it's very amusing and it's very impressive. But that person, I can assure you, has no concept of time yet. And it's perfectly natural. People think they've got all the time in the world. But as you grow older, you realize that the time is a very particular commodity. And you develop your own relationship with it. And then when it's applied to music, if you are the master of time, something magical happens. If you're not, you'll just play beautifully.
It's funny. Last week, I had a conversation with a former semi-professional soccer player, and there was soccer on TV. I'm not a great player, but I'm an admirer, and I asked him what he admired about this great athlete on the TV screen, and he said he slows time down.
And well, that's it.
I see a similar.
I mean, it's true. I'm a huge soccer fan. Of course, I call it football here, and I go to matches. I can talk for hours with you, but it's exactly the same principle in many ways. Because, and Michael Jordan, you remember how he used to just be suspended in the air. But I often use football analogies. For instance, like a conductor having a score is one of the biggest advantages and requirements. Is you can sort of what I call, you have to see the field. In other words, the whole journey from the beginning to the end. It's like the greatest players, they always see everything else. It's not enough that they have great technique and they can dribble, but they see what else is going on the field. They never even look at the ball. The ball seems to be permanently attached to their feet. God knows how. But they always look who else is available and what else is happening, and they see the combination two or three moves ahead. So it could be very much, as you said, you know, it's the time. He slows down the time, and he has this extra moment to do extraordinary things. It's very similar.
Let me ask you this, because we talked about your conception of the piece is not, I mean, you don't dramatically alter the perception of the piece, but how you approach it, the interaction with the musicians,
right.
More so now, the master of time in Rubato. But could you give me a primary personal goal, you know, with this upcoming performance, or what you feel like you need to do in order to be satisfied with your performance of this concerto?
Well, I think, in any case, you know, I just had a really special performance in Bologna, just on the 19th of December, where I played the Beethoven, having not played it for 4.5 years, I think, before that.
Mm.
And that went exceptionally well. With the orchestra, I never performed before. And so with the conductor, I never performed before. So those things normally, you know, carry inside potential dangers. So, you know, here I have a very familiar situation. It's an orchestra I've been closest for the last 10 years, closer than to any other orchestra, and spend more time on stage. And the conductor that I worked with before in the Brahms, but also who's always near me whenever I'm in Greensboro. So I have such familiar situations and the halls I know very well. But I'm not taking anything for granted, because just as in Bologna, there were two unknown factors. So it could have gone wrong, but it didn't. Here is a danger that familiarity could sometimes backfire. And just when you think, oh, here I'm at home and it should be, oh, no. So I'll be even more on my toes, because I'll be looking for enhancing the performance that I just had last month, rather than just, oh, it just went so well, so it must go well at home. No, I think it's more responsibility. You're playing for the home crowd. You have to rise to a different level. And if I'm able also to take all my friends, musicians of the orchestra, Nate, on a special journey with me to the spheres which are sometimes quite familiar to me, I'll be very happy.
Well, I'm very happy. Thank you for talking with me.
Great, David. Thanks so much. Always such a pleasure to talk to you.
Dmitri Sitkovetsky. Dmitri will be performing at the Sitkovetsky and Friends Chamber Series on September 25th. Until then, you can stay up to date with the Greensboro Symphony at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. It's time for one more break, but when we return, associate producer Bethany Chafin sits down with Press 53 author Taylor Brown. His collection of Southern Tales is called In the Season of Blood and Gold. Back in 60 seconds. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Stay tuned for Triad to Do about 10 minutes from now. But first, producer Bethany Chafin chats with a North Carolina author on the rise.
Taylor Brown's debut collection of short fiction came out in May of last year. In the Season of Blood and Gold, published by Press 53, includes 12 stories of dynamic characters and timeless landscapes, from alligator wrestlers to Confederate soldiers, and a tattooed artist exploring the map to her heart and to her mother's. The stories are impressive. Writer Charles Dodd has said of the collection, "With ferocious economy and a great big heart, Taylor Brown writes one of the best debuts I've ever picked up. These are stories, verses, meditations, and accusations. Everything, in short, you could hope to get from important fiction. This work demands your attention." Taylor stopped by WFDD to tell me more about his process as a writer.
Well, my name's John Lee Pettimore.
Same as my daddy. For me, I find some little detail in everyday life or in a book or somewhere, and maybe it's an image or it's... A lot of the time it's a phrase or a word. It's something like that. It's just a small nugget, and then the whole story grows out of that. For instance, I have a story that's not in this collection, but it's called Cajun Reeboks, and it's because a lot of shrimpers and fishermen wear those white rubber boots, and they call them Cajun Reeboks. And the whole story was from me learning that term. And my favorite stories usually start with something really small that I can't get out of my head or just really interests me. And I know there's a story there, and I just sit down and it just starts, hopefully it just starts happening.
What writers inspire you and why?
I would say Faulkner and McCarthy are my two favorites. And then I do end up gravitating toward a lot of Southern writers. And I know a lot of people, that's always a question, or people are sometimes defensive. I'm not just a Southern writer. I just happen to live in the South. And I agree with that, but for whatever reason, maybe it's the language, it's the people, it's the settings, but, Ron Rash, Pinckney Benedict, Chris Offutt, there's just so many that I really, really enjoy that, are from Georgia or North Carolina or Virginia or Kentucky or West Virginia. And Barry Hanna is another one. I gravitate toward a lot of these writers that write about a South that's populated more with PBR than mint juleps, because I'm not sure that mint julep South really exists anymore. It does exist, but it's kind of a caricature of itself. Those are settings and a language and a dialogue that I just have an affinity for, that I gravitate to.
Overall, what struck me about your characters, or the characters that really stuck with me, were the ones that had this very almost intimidating, in some ways needing to be ferocious or just strong in a really epic way, mm-hmm. exterior. And then you show these details about them. For example, I think it's in Bone Valley, mm-hmm. your character, he cuts the plastic rings that keep the six-pack together because he's worried about the sea turtles. Or he buttons his shirt before he goes to wrangle an alligator and becomes soaked in the victim's blood who's been attacked by this alligator. Like, those little details I thought were really captivating. And so that juxtaposition, I guess I'm curious about. Is that something you have fun with, or you think is almost a part of any character that has to have that dynamic?
That's a really good question. I don't think that I am doing that on purpose necessarily, but I think that it's just, I think people are like that. I think when you talk about the character of the alligator wrestler Hart in Bone Valley, I think I do remember growing up around these characters, these older men who have this very tough exterior. And I think that you get that in a lot of places. Maybe you get it more in the South because there is more of this kind of masculine culture. And you realize but a lot of them are really gentle on the inside despite that exterior. And that's somehow a really powerful thing to me. It just makes a character interesting to me. If they're just one-sided, then there isn't a whole lot to learn from them. There isn't a whole lot for us. We're not going to you're not going to feel like you know this person or like you want to know this person because they're not going to seem like a real person. I think that most of us have a exterior that we show to a world and an interior that we don't show so often. You know, we show it to close people around us, and maybe in some moments it gets shown. And maybe I'm trying to find those moments too where, you know, that a violent, cruel person, the gentleness they have inside comes out, or even the opposite, someone that, you know, does have a gentle exterior, and then at some point, you know, something really tough or even cruel comes out. Because I think those are defining moments, and maybe that's one thing that we're looking for when we're reading, you know, and we're trying to, when we're kind of getting to know a character.
Writer Taylor Brown. His short story collection, In the Season of Blood and Gold, was recently a finalist for the 2015 International Book Award in the fiction short story category. Fans of Taylor's writing can look forward to his first novel, Fallen Land, which will be released in January of 2016 by St. Martin's Press. The first chapter of the novel is actually the title story of In the Season of Blood and Gold. The novel focuses on two orphans on the run from Confederate guerrillas near the end of the Civil War. For more information on Taylor Brown and his writing, visit our website at wfdd.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm Bethany Chafin. Welcome to Triad To Do. I'm Bethany Chafin, here with Eddie Garcia, and I want to let you know that our guest today is Kim Kardashian.
What?
Actually, I'm just kidding. Wait, don't tell me. Took care of that last week. So, but actually, I have something for our listeners in case they are curious about ways to celebrate the summer solstice, which is happening this Sunday. That means the longest day of the year, most hours of sunlight. So get out there and enjoy it. One way you can start to do that is Friday, June 19th, 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. The Weatherspoon Art Museum is hosting their annual summer solstice party. So this means there's going to be music, food trucks. The gallery exhibits are going to be open. There are two currently. The first one is Tom Burkhart, full stop. The second is McDonald Bain, two parts art, one part science. This is going to be a really fun event in Greensboro, so check it out if you're looking for a way to celebrate the summer solstice.
Cool. Yeah. Well, if you're curious about the rock music scene here in Winston-Salem, this might be a good opportunity to see what's being created locally. So Friday night, June 19th, there's a CD and cassette release concert at the Garage in downtown Winston-Salem, and the band releasing the album is called Dark Prophet Tongueless Monk, and the album is called The Path. Now, this is a band that started a few years ago as a solo project of Jacob Leonard, who's a bassist, guitarist, keyboardist, singer, and songwriter, plays all kinds of things. He's played in a lot of bands in the area over the past 10 years. So this project grew to a duo when Jacob teamed up with Dane Walters, and some of you may know Dane Walters' visual artwork. He's part of the Delurk Gallery Artists Collective. He's also a great drummer, but he hadn't played in years, so Jacob brought him into this project. So I thought this week, rather than trying to describe the music, we'd have a little listen to Dark Prophet Tongueless Monk. This is a little snippet from the song 10-Year Dream. Dark Prophet Tongueless Monk releasing their debut album on CD and cassette, and it's being released by Reanimator Records. Once again, the show is Friday, June 19th at the Garage, and the opening band is Nashville's Linear Downfall.
Dream,
Well, that's a wrap on today's show. Triad Arts Weekend's executive producer is David Ford. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find podcasts and archived episodes on our website. It's wfdd.org, then click on Triad Arts. Follow us on Twitter at Triad Arts Speak. You can follow WFDD on Facebook as well. Triad Arts Weekend is a production of 88.5 WFDD Public Radio for the Piedmont. I'm technical producer Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.